Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There are mysteries to plumb in the human mind. My guest today, autistic savant Daniel Tammet, has a memory and processing ability for numbers and language and dates out of history that far surpasses the ordinary person's. There are perhaps only 50 in the world like him. But he says his mind is not so different from yours, and that we can all expand our minds. This hour, On Point savant Daniel Tammet on the wide horizons of the human mind. Joining me now from New York is Daniel Tammet. He's an autistic savant, one of just a few dozen so-called prodigious savants alive in the world today. He described growing up with Asperger's syndrome and synesthesia, a cross-wiring of the senses, in his best-selling memoir, Born on a Blue Day. His new book is Embracing the Wide Sky, a tour across the horizons of the mind. Daniel Tammet joins us from New York. Mr. Tammet, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It's wonderful to have you with us again. We enjoyed talking with you after your memoir came out. Some people will have heard that or read that. Others will not. Can you give us a sense, for those who don't know your story, Daniel, of how your mind and capacities are different from the norm?
Well, as you mentioned just now, Tom, I have what scientists call high-functioning autistic savant syndrome. It's a very unusual condition. As you said, there are maybe 50 savants in the world today. And what this condition means is that I have a mind that has unusual strengths and unusual weaknesses. I am very good at doing all kinds of things with numbers, counting and doing multiplications and thinking about mathematical problems and so on. I have a very good ability for language as well and linguistics and so on. At the same time, I find many things that people often take for granted very, very difficult, such as having conversations, for example, as we're having now. This is an ability that I didn't understand as a child and had to teach myself consciously over many years how to look somebody in the eye, how to understand body language, niceties of social interaction were all things that were very strange and foreign to me and took a long time to learn.
We are, in that case, particularly grateful to you for having the conversation today. You say strengths and weaknesses. I'm not sure people will necessarily understand just how extraordinary some of these strengths are. Can you give some examples of the kind of thing that your mind permits you to do that most people might find mind-boggling?
Well, in March 2004, on what Americans celebrate as Pi Day, March 14th.
That's pi as in pi, the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of any circle.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yes. And it starts 3.14, hence March 14th.
Right, right.
And I went to Oxford in England and sat in a museum dedicated to the history of science. There was a blackboard of Einstein's on the wall opposite me, and this was his birthday, coincidentally, March 14th as well. And I recited the number pi from memory to 22,514 decimal places. It took me 5 hours and 9 minutes.
Let's just pause right there. Now, pi, everybody learns this in, I don't know what, sixth or seventh grade in the United States. It's, everybody knows, as you say, it starts off 3.14158. We may even know it out that far. You went out to 22,500-plus digits from memory. Give us a sense of how you did that. What was going on in your mind that made that possible?
Well, first of all, it's 3.14159.
Excuse me, just to
correct you, Tom. That's okay. No,
sorry. Jeez, I get up to four and I'm messing up. Sorry.
Well, I have an, as you say, an unusual ability for numbers. That's one of my abilities. Numbers for me are not just squiggles of ink on a page. They have colours, they have shapes, and they may even have personalities for me. When I was a young child and I really was struggling with social interaction and mm-hmm. not understanding how to play with other children, how to make friends and so on, well, the things that I did understand were numbers, were words, and so these were my friends, and they came to life for me, and my mind found ways to understand their patterns and the relationships between them using pictures and imagery and so on that my mind created by itself. And so when I'm thinking of a particularly huge number like pi is actually an infinite number. It goes on forever. Mm-hmm. Even if we had a piece of paper the size of the universe to write it down on, we still wouldn't have enough room. And well, this fascinating number, the most famous number in mathematics, I will see as a landscape of numbers, the shapes and the colours knitting together to form these beautiful pictures in my mind. And I'm able to retrace these beautiful shapes in my head and retrieve the numbers and recite them back.
Take us more deeply into that. You say, for you, numbers have character, color, almost associations as if friends or people. But I can imagine a lot of listeners saying, you know, I can't even remember the name of every person I know, let alone the position in pi of all these numbers. So that might suggest that your mind is fundamentally wired differently, yet in your new book, Embracing the Wide Sky, I think you're saying that minds are not so different. Which is it, and how's the distinction work?
Well, you're correct that many people have thought for a very long time, including many scientists, that the way that autistic savants think is fundamentally different to how you or anyone else would. And that's understandable because we know very little about savant syndrome. We know very little, in fact, about the brain itself, how anyone's brain works. What is helping us today is two things. First of all, we have technology now that we didn't have just a few years ago, the ability to scan people's brains, to look inside people's heads. So when I'm doing sums and thinking of these numerical landscapes of learning a language in a week, like I did for Icelandic, people can actually look into my brains, and researchers can look and see what my brain is doing, and that gives us clues as to finding the differences, but also the similarities between how different people's minds work. The other thing is that we have now, of course, a culture which is much more open and ability to diagnose very high-functioning forms of autism, such as mine, that weren't diagnosable when I was a child, for example. And so it's that ability to articulate the autistic experience, the savant experience, to actually explain to researchers and to the public how my mind works in books such as Embracing the Wide Sky that give people these insights. What I'm saying is that my mind isn't so different. And the reason I'm saying this is because, well, there are many reasons, but one of the most fundamental is that, for example, autistic thought uses imagery, as I mentioned, mm-hmm. and associations and so on. But every time that you're daydreaming, every time that you're making puns, every time that you're using a metaphor, all relatively common activities that everyone engages in, mm-hmm. you're actually thinking a lot like I do, a lot like an autistic savant does. So this does suggest that there are important similarities that haven't been picked up on by researchers before, and which I do explore in detail in my new book.
We'll look at those. We have many listeners with questions as well, Daniel. Let me begin to bring them in. From Fort Myers, Florida, we're joined by Robert. Robert, you're on the air with Daniel Tammet.
Thank you. I very, very much enjoyed the television program featuring you and Kim Peek. My question would be, do you feel that the human mind has a capacity, for instance, could it be filled with information until you you couldn't go any further.
In other words, is there infinite capacity for memory and storage? Robert, thanks for that. Daniel Tammet, what do you say?
Well, I think there is, pretty much. I mean, to give an example which I use at the beginning of my book, there are more connections in the brain, anyone's brain, than there are stars in the known universe. So the capacity of the human brain is just amazing. We have no idea just what it is capable of. And so the things that I do are, in a sense, just one small part of that power.
But when you were reciting pi for 5+ hours at Oxford, and at 22,500 plus digits, you ran out. Was it because your capacity ran out, your visualization could go no further, you were just tired and hungry?
I think it was more that, yes. I was very, very tired after so many hours, and it's a pretty lonely experience. You're on your own, you're not allowed to talk to anyone, of course. This was a European record. I raised lots of money, I'm glad to say, for the National Epilepsy Charity. I had epileptic seizures as a young child, as many with autism unfortunately have. And so it wasn't really a case of not being able to go on any further in terms of my brain's ability. It was, yes, the fact that I am only human. And so at some point I did get very tired. But yes, in theory, if I wasn't so tired, I could have gone on and on much, much further still.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with autistic savant Daniel Tammet about what his unusual mind shows us about all our minds. Steve is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air with Daniel Tammet.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I'm a mathematician, and I'm interested to hear about the description about the beauty of the long digits of pi. Just a technical comment. Pi is what's called a normal number, which means that if you write out all its digits, you can't tell the digits of pi from some random sequence of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that if a person who could find beauty in the many digits of pi could find beauty in any given random sequence of digits, or in the or in some other normal number? And I'd be interested to hear more about, how that beauty would be described.
Steve, may I just ask you to clarify, as a mathematician, are you imagining that a non-normal number, in other words, one that had some kind of logic to it, not randomness, might be more beautiful?
No. I mean, pi is a very beautiful number.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of beauty in these numbers, independent of what their digit sequences look like, their properties and where they come from and how they relate to, other
mm-hmm.
things, like
mm-hmm.
the formula e to the I pi plus 1 equals 0. That's pretty beautiful without the digits. But, one interesting thing might be to look at numbers that not everything, their properties aren't fully known, and see if some sort of observation could be made. And I'd say one vote I'd have is for a number called Euler's gamma, which is too technical to get into. But there's lots of commonly occurring numbers that come up where their normality or other properties aren't known, and it would be interesting to have somebody's perspective who could absorb digit sequences like that.
The whole thing. Steve, stick with us. Daniel Tammet, how about it? Random versus non-random numbers and the beauty in numbers that you described, does it make a difference to you?
Well, I think it does. I think beauty is a fundamental quality of how we understand the world around us and how we think. And I'm reading at the moment a fascinating biography of a physicist, a Nobel Prize winner from Britain, called Paul Dirac. And Paul was a colleague of Einstein's and other great scientists, and made great discoveries regarding atoms quantum mechanics. And the biography actually explores the possibility that, that his mind was a high-functioning autistic as well, although at that point in time, certainly, it wouldn't have been diagnosable. And in his exploration of numbers and their properties and how they relate to quantum mechanics and so on, he, like Einstein, made a very big point about the importance of visualization, the ability of the human mind to visualize the properties of nature and the fabric of reality and the beauty of these equations and the beauty of these numbers and how important it was even before they had been able to do the calculations that proved whether this equation was right or wrong. They were able to say intuitively, I think this is right because it's so beautiful, it has to be right.
Steve, as a mathematician, does that resonate with you or leave you shaking your head in wonderment?
No, absolutely. I think there's a lot of open questions, and I think what he's referring to is the connection between quantum mechanics and the Riemann hypothesis, or what's basically the zeros of the Riemann zeta function. And I point out there's a great book written by I'm blanking on the air now here, but there's a great recent book on that, if you Google that, where that's discussed. So there are many open questions about deep mathematical problems, the Riemann hypothesis, which is important if you dig into it, and deep physical properties of the universe, quantum mechanics, that aren't fully explored. So, yeah, that resonates very much.
The Riemann zeta function, you've got us right off into wonderful territory. Steve, thanks for calling. Let me get another Richard. Richard, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Daniel. Good to talk to you.
Hi.
Just a quick comment on that last call. I'm also a mathematician, and actually, although pi does exhibit statistical randomness, I believe we have no proof that it's a normal number. But anyway, never mind that.
You're over our heads, but we'll take the debate.
What I wanted to ask, Mr. Tammet, when I was 17 years old, I memorized pi to about 2,000 places. But I'm not a savant of any sort, and I had to use incredibly hard work over the course of 2 or 3 months to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, first of all, I assume you can imprint digit patterns on your mind very easily. Let me know if that's true. And then also, correspondingly, what kind of pure information processing thinking do you find difficult that would correspond to how I found pi memorization difficult, I'm wondering.
Daniel?
Well, yes, certainly the way that I think about numbers means that when I look at a sequence of numbers, first of all, I find them just very, very beautiful. And so that beauty is attractive to me. It pulls me in. I want to learn these numbers. I want to understand these numbers. And it's true that my mind has a way of forming these kinds of visual architectures in my mind that just makes these numbers that much easier for me to remember. In terms of the things that I find difficult, well, abstract thinking, all kinds of abstract thinking, which would involve a lot of mathematics, I find very, very difficult. And when I was at school, algebra was actually very, very difficult for me because I didn't understand that we could take numbers, things that for me have a sense, have shapes and colors and textures and so on, and replace them with symbols that lost these associations. I didn't have any of these associations with the symbols that we use in algebra. And in fact, in reading this account by Graham Farmelo on the life of Paul Dirac, this Nobel Prize-winning physicist, mm-hmm. who may also have been autistic, he also found algebra very difficult and preferred to think of his equations in terms of imagery, which again is what Einstein, who some people do say may have been autistic, did too. He was very much wanting for all kinds of equations to think of them in terms of pictures and to imagine the universe through his mind, and rather than, of course, he could do the algebra, he understood the algebra very well, but his mind, for him, was the pictures that made a difference, that helped him to really understand what these equations meant.
So what does that tell us about the interaction of a mind like yours and what we might call an ordinary mind? I mean, Richard calls in, he spent 2 or 3 months of hard work, you know, elbow grease, laboriously memorizing. Are you suggesting that somehow ordinary people could sit back and unleash a kind of daydream of understanding of math or languages? You learned how to speak Icelandic in a week. Are we slaves of that labor, or is that just the fact of life, the necessity for a normal mind to memorize through, you know, grunt effort?
Well, there are two things that I want to say then in response to that question, and they're linked, and it's important to make this clear. First of all, I need to establish two things for my argument to work, that my mind is not so different from yours. First, I need to demonstrate that autistic minds aren't so different, and secondly, show how things that you can do and everyone can do relate to the things that I can do. Well, first of all, I want to talk about Oliver Sacks for a moment, because Oliver Sacks is a very famous scientist, of course, and his account of autistic savant twins in his best-selling book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
This is the professor of neurology, psychiatry at Columbia University.
That's
His vision kind of dramatized in the Rain Man movie with Dustin Hoffman that everybody knows, his vision of autism.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Oliver Sacks describes these twins who are able to swap 20-digit prime numbers without using computers or any kind of calculation that he can see. And in his same account describes, as you mentioned in the Rain Man movie, the dramatization of this scene, where the twins drop a box of matchsticks and count them instantly. 111 of them,
and in the flash of an eye,
In the flash of an eye, and now if this is true, if Oliver Sacks' account is accurate, then my case is no good at all, because of course people can't do this. Most people can't do this and can't hope to do this. Mm-hmm. But as I point out in Embracing the White Sky, Sacks' account is actually flawed. And research into his descriptions of the twins and the things that they could do have demonstrated this. And in the book, I give an alternative explanation for what the twins were doing and how they did what they did, which takes away all of the supernatural elements to Lesak's story.
How do you describe it? Do you say they didn't count those matchsticks in a nanosecond, or they did it unlike his description of the process?
Well, what I suggest is that the matches were already in the twins' possession. According to Sacks's account, he came into the hospital where the twins were staying, and the matches were already there. The twins had them already.
So it was a con job? They'd already counted them?
It wasn't a con job in that sense. They had counted them, I believe, and this is the theory that I put forward, which doesn't require any supernatural explanations of their ability. Mm-hmm. 111 is an interesting number, and I think it's more than a coincidence that there were exactly 111 matchsticks. This is for someone like myself who perhaps thinks of numbers in the way that these twins did. It's a beautiful number. It's 37, which is a prime number, multiplied by 3. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you look at 111, one can't help but think of matchsticks.
Yes.
So I do wonder if these twins, to them, this number was so beautiful that they wanted to keep it, wanted to treat it as a prized possession.
So you push back against a supernatural explanation as one prong of argument, and then?
Well, and then if this is indeed the case, and Sacks' account is wrong, and autistic minds function not so differently from everyone else's, then the other prong of the argument is, how are we similar? And one of the things that I explore in the book is the intuitions that everyone, savant or not, the intuitions that we're all born with for numbers and for language as well. And my theory is that my abilities are based on these instincts as well, that there is a continuum, a long, long continuum of human talent, and rather than considering savant abilities as being somehow off the charts, supernatural or whatever else, it's on that continuum. It's a natural part of the human spectrum of possibility and potential. It's on the extreme end, of course, but it's there nonetheless. And to give an example, mathematicians very often, when they're meeting together, will ask themselves all kinds of strange questions, such as, how many piano tuners are there in Chicago? Now, nobody can know the answer to that, but what they're doing is they're using their natural instincts and they're training them to try to come up with the best estimate based on what they might know about pianos, tuning pianos, and the city of Chicago. And this is what a lot of maths is about, taking certain assumptions and working out the relationships and the patterns within that information. And this is something that we all do. Everyone is born with an ability to count basic fundamental quantities, and then our ability to do mathematics is a growth out of that natural ability. And it seems to me that my mind obviously is wired slightly differently. The biology of my mind and its development is different, but not fundamentally. And these instincts are things that can be trained. Adults tend to lose them. But these things that everyone has in them naturally and can bring back out.
I'm sure listeners are wondering if indeed that's true of themselves. It's hard to picture, but perhaps you're right. We have a lot of questions here from Chesapeake, Virginia. Curtis. Curtis, you're on the air with Daniel Temmett.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, Tom. Hi, Daniel. My question is, Daniel, the more I listen to you, the more I see a correlation between your hypothesis or realization of the infinite aspect of mind and the Buddhist realization of the infinite aspect of mind. And I'm wondering if you have explored that at all.
Daniel Temmett, how about it?
Well, I certainly have a lot of respect for Buddhism, because it's a fascinating philosophy, which is an attempt to understand reality using nothing but the mind. And this is a lot of what scientists are doing, of course, when we're exploring language or mathematics or physics and so on. But I'm not a Buddhist myself, I should say. And I don't see any incompatibility myself between reason and faith. Certainly the mind does have immense potential, and any philosophy that teach people this is a good one.
I wonder, though, you were saying earlier how while you could recite pi and visualize it, algebra was difficult for you as a symbolic representation. I wonder if any religion might pose the same difficulty, a kind of symbolic representation of the actuality. If that's an insult to Buddhism, forgive me, Buddhists, I'm beyond my pay grade there. But do you know what I mean, Daniel?
Yes, I think so. I should say that I'm a Christian, first of all. I explain at the end of Born on a Blue Day, my first book, my memoir, how I came to Christian faith. I don't explore those questions so much in my new book. What I'm focusing on there is how the mind works, how my mind works, how everyone's mind works, the things that we have in common, the things that anyone can do to make the most of how their mind works. Of course, symbols and so on can get in the way. One of the things that I found very interesting is the comparison between savants and young children, because young children are pretty good learners too. And so I make this link in the book and explore this in quite some detail.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with autistic savant Daniel Temmett about what his unusual mind and others like his, and there are not many, but what they show us about all our minds. His new book is Embracing the Wide Sky, a tour across the horizons of the mind. Daniel Temmett joins us from New York. And Daniel, we've got a question here from our website, onpointradio.org. Wendy asks, she says, as a poet, I'm curious if Mr. Temmett writes poetry considering his gift for metaphor. At the very least, I'm hopeful that he reads it, and if so, who might be his favorite poets. Daniel?
That's a very good question. Yes, I do write poetry, and in Embracing the Wide Sky, I publish one of my poems, so I hope Wendy will read it and will email me through my website and give me her feedback. I'll be curious to know. I love the poems of Emily Dickinson. And in fact, the title of my book, Embracing the Wide Sky, is based on a poem by Emily Dickinson, which starts, the brain is wider than the sky. And this idea that our minds are just so huge that even the universe is something that we're capable of contemplating and analyzing and studying is when you think about it, amazing.
Could you go on with that poem a little bit? Do you have it memorized?
I don't have it memorized. It's a short poem. I put it into the front of the book.
I've got a bit here. The brain is wider than the sky, for put them side by side, the one the other will contain with ease, and you beside. Now help us understand how you can know pi to 22,000 digits and not know one of your favorite poems. I don't mean any disrespect. I'm just very curious about that.
Well, I do love reading poetry. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily love memorizing mm-hmm. poetry, which is different. And I think as Wendy is saying, what's so interesting in poetry is the choice of words, the metaphors, the ideas. And too much memorization in terms of poetry, I think, can kind of take us away from that. Just to make the point as well, one of the things that I describe in the book as well is creativity, because where does this ability come from to create mm-hmm. these landscapes out of sequences or numbers, this ability that I have to invent words in other languages, to invent my own language, one of the things I talk about in Embracing the Wide Sky, and to write poetry, to write books, and so on. And I come up with a theory, which I believe is an original theory, that creativity is based on a property, a cognitive property in the brain, that scientists call hyperconnectivity. What that means basically is that when we're using our brains, the brain is segmenting its main activities, thinking about numbers or mm-hmm. recognizing faces and so on, belong to different regions of the brain. And this activity is usually kept separate because there is a risk of information overload and psychosis and so on mm-hmm. if these all this information is allowed to mix randomly. Mm-hmm. And in cases where people have autism, have had epileptic seizures, like myself, and in forms of mental illness as well, these regions can cross-communicate. And in this instance, we do have an unusual convergence of all kinds of usually unconnected feelings and ideas and emotions and memories. And my theory is that this is the basis for exceptional creativity, both in the case of myself and also in the case of a poet like Emily Dickinson, in the case of a scientist like Einstein, for example, mm-hmm. who could make all kinds of unusual leaps and associations between things that we hadn't necessarily thought of as having any kind of relationship previously.
She goes on to write there, if I may, just because it inspired you, and it is inspiring. In the same poem she writes, "The brain is deeper than the sea, for hold them blue to blue, the one the other will absorb as sponges buckets do." That sort of knocking down walls and allowing all the information to come together does sound very powerful, but you have also spoken and written, Daniel Tammet, about how too much information can kind of make people stupid.
Well, yes. I mean, information is only as useful as our ability to make sense of it and to make relationships and associations in our mind with it. Too much information, and we're bombarded today in an age of internet and advertising, rolling news and so on, with so much information. And I think what has been written about this so far is that the question of the quality of that information, and it's true that a lot of that information isn't necessarily a very useful to us, and also the quantity, as you said, is just so much of it. But in the book, I explore the organization of that information, how we organize information mm-hmm. in our minds, how we use ideas to make sense of information and to be able to relate it. And most people find this very difficult to do, and so I think this is why people get this sense of feeling overwhelmed by having just so much information. And so in the book I give some suggestions about how people can learn to navigate their way through all of this informational overload. And
can you give us the simple version of that? You'd have to have the book to get it all, but can you give us the kind of summary of what is the way? If one were to open one's mind to that ocean of information, how do you suggest beginning not to be overwhelmed by it, but rather empowered, made more creative by it?
Well, going back just briefly to what I was saying about young children and the relationship between young children and savants, the relationship there is that very young children, we don't give them grammar books, we don't give them verb tables, and yet they acquire a perfect understanding of their native language at a very, very young age. And this is to do with natural intuitions, the instincts that they're born with, that we're all born with for mm-hmm. numbers and for language, the ability to count and to do sums. At an early age, scientists have found that very young children who haven't yet learned the rules of arithmetic can do all kinds of sums using their intuitions, their ability to weigh a number in their mind and to evaluate it. And we lose these abilities as we grow older, partly because of the changes in the brain, biology, but also education and the way that children are often educated, and we lose touch with those instincts and those intuitions. Now, information and learning and so on, if we can get back into touch with those instincts and intuitions, and in the book I give lots of examples. To give just one example then, mm-hmm. in terms of language, you're wanting to learn a new language, Spanish or French or whatever that language that would be, and of course it's a huge task, there's so much information to learn. Where do you start? Well, one place to start is with our own instincts. You take a word and you understand if there a relationship between the sounds in that word and what it means. Now, in the past, scientists would have said, no, words are random, like the numbers of the digits in the number pi, they're totally random. But we now know that isn't necessarily true. There is a branch of linguistics that interests me a lot and I'm doing research into called phonesthesia, which is the idea that there is a relationship often between how words are formed, the sounds that we use in certain words, and its relationship with what that word actually means. And they've found all kinds of correspondences that come out of our minds. Language is an invention of our minds. So these are instincts and these are relationships that are already in our heads, and we just need to unlock them, just need to train them.
You have a phenomenal capacity to do that. You famously learned Icelandic, or a huge chunk of it, in 1 week. Is there a phrase from Icelandic, the language, that demonstrates that theory that you're describing there of sound and meanings relation?
Yes, I'll give two examples mm-hmm. if I can. Icelandic, first of all, when I was learning Icelandic, and it was such a huge task, even for a savant in 1 week to learn a language and then to go on to TV and give a whole interview in Icelandic. Mm-hmm. And I did use these intuitions. Now, for me and for young children, they come naturally. For adults who have lost touch of these instincts, they don't, but they could. And so I give lots and lots of examples. I think that's the best way for people to learn, to
What's
have lots
one?
Of examples. Well, in Icelandic, lots of words that describe round things start with the sound H-N, hna. And so the word for a button, for example, is mm-hmm. a hnapa. The word for the globe is hnata. The word for rolling yourself into a ball is hnipra. Mm-hmm. And as we go on and on, we find this association in lots and lots of words describing round things, starting with this sound. And in scientists have found that these associations are probably found in every language. And just to give one other example, which applies to pretty much all languages, when we're describing small things, we often will find that words in other languages have the letter I, the sound I in them. So in English, we would say tiny or little or mm-hmm. itsy-bitsy.
The diminutive sound.
Mm-hmm. The diminutive sound, which, of course, itself has the letter I in it, the mm-hmm. sound I. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish word for child, of course, niño. Mm-hmm. At the same time, languages will use an opposite sound, A or an O, to describe round things, large things, heavy things.
Rotund.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Gros, mm-hmm. grand, gordo, and mm-hmm. so on. So these are patterns that anyone can learn, and I give lots and lots of examples from all kinds of languages in the book, and many of them I'd never heard of before. And when I give this test to people, when I say to them, look, here are words from all kinds of languages around the world, and you've never seen these words, of course, you don't know what these languages are, and I give you a list of what they might mean, can you pick the right meaning from them? And people get them pretty much all right, and it's amazing. And
just sort of open up the mind and be free enough to feel it.
Exactly. To feel the words, to feel the numbers, a little bit how I do with the numbers of the digits of pi.
Daniel, forgive me, but I have so many people who'd like to speak with you. Bill in Columbia, South Carolina. You've been waiting so long, sir. Welcome, and you're on the air.
Thank you. I hope you all are well, and thank you for taking my call. I would, I'd love for Daniel to touch on what it was like to grow up as an autistic. I have a 9.5-year-old, very high-functioning autistic little boy. He was diagnosed at 2.5, and he's, you know, he's bright, independent of his autism. But this is really, you know, all the reading I've done, I've not really heard of this autistic sort of savant categorization. So I'd love for Daniel to really touch on growing up as an autistic, you know, 5, 10, 15-year-old.
Bill, what's your son's name, if I may ask?
His name is Wills.
Wills, wonderful. Daniel, what light can you shed here?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that autism is a profoundly complex condition. There are perhaps as many types of autism as there are people with the condition. So every case is unique. Every person's experience of it will be different. But of course, there are commonalities, things that we find very difficult, having too much noise, not being able to predict what is about to happen in our environment. Touch can sometimes be very difficult. Feeling overwhelmed very often, a sense of isolation because we don't understand the world as it is. And this is obviously a source of weakness, a source of confusion and pain. It can be very difficult. But at the same time, it can be positive. It can be a strength in one sense because it gives us a mind that is immensely curious. We don't take things for granted. We don't make assumptions that most people would make about how the world works. We want to question it because we don't understand it. And I think the other thing is it gives me an appreciation for just how much variety there is in something like intelligence. What is intelligence? What is it when we say that somebody is smart or not smart? Because autistic people often aren't associated with high intelligence, or that's often been the portrayal, unfortunately, of them. In the past, savants, of course, had that very unfortunate title, idiot savants. Mm. And obviously our culture is changing now. We have much greater respect for the diversity of minds. And in Embracing the Wide Sky, I did do my first ever supervised IQ test because I wanted to see what it was like, what it would be like to do an IQ test, to go through that experience, to see how that definition stands up to how a mind like mine works. Mm. I actually did very, very well. I won't say what score I got. It's in the book, but it was very, very high. But what I did find in that experience was just how banal many of those questions were, how limited they were. And there is, I was invited to join the Mensa Society, high IQ society, and I didn't want to join because I don't think that's necessarily the most fruitful representation of what intelligence is. And to quote Groucho Marx, I don't really want to belong to any club that would have me as a member.
We love it. Bill, good luck to you and Wills there in Columbia. Let's go to Kathy in Williamsville, New York. Kathy, you're on the air with Daniel Tammet.
Hi, Tom. I have a question. When were you diagnosed? At what age? What was your early schooling like? Public education today seems to hammer away at your deficits and not take what you're strong at and help you get better at that. They're going to take what you're weak at and try to bring you up. And the other thing is you mentioned that your brain has been studied a lot. What areas on a SPECT exam or when they're watching your brain work, what is working differently? What do they see on those scans that are different than a normal brain?
Kathy, thanks very much. Daniel?
Well, I had, in many respects, a very normal education. In what I mean by that is I was brought up in a very poor part of England, in London, where I was born. And my parents were very poor. We didn't have access to gifted programs or to tutors and so on. I'm one of nine children as well, so that complicates the picture quite a lot. My parents just didn't have the time to dedicate a lot of their resources to any one child.
On the other hand, you had a lot of siblings to model on, I suppose.
Exactly, and that's, I think, one reason that my social skills were able to develop so much. In terms of the brain and where it's different, what they have found is that there are differences in the frontal lobes. That's at the front of the brain. It's the part of the brain that's involved in imagination in terms of visual thinking. And this would make a lot of sense. I do think a lot in pictures, in associations, like poets and people like Einstein and Dirac and others wrote in their memoirs that they did as well. And so you're absolutely right. What we need to do is focus on people's strengths as well as their weaknesses. The future is just such a scary place. We have no idea what's going to happen. It's such a complex world today. And I think if we are to face those challenges, we need to have a respect for every kind of mind, bring every kind of intelligence in, and understand that we need a different kind of thinking to solve the problems of today, a different kind of thinking than the one that caused these problems in the first place.
Let us go out with one last stanza from your poetess, maybe hero, Emily Dickinson. In the same poem, she says, "The brain is just the weight of God, for heft them pound for pound, and they will differ, if they do, as syllable from sound." That is, scarcely at all, Daniel Tammet's new book is Embracing the Wide Sky, a tour across the horizons of the mind. Daniel Tammet, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.